Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hello and welcome to Man on the Post Weekend Review. My name is Dave and this week I'm joined by everyone asked me, who the hell is he, that weirdo with five colours in his hair? It's Simon O'Regan.
It's been a long time since I've been able to get colours in my hair. And to be honest, I think the amount and number of colours that I used to put in my hair has probably contributed to the fact that I'm no longer able to.
Oh, very philosophical. Don't dye your hair, kids, or else you'll end up bald like Uncle Simon. But also, living the life of Riley, if you'll believe the papers. The entirely fictional papers, I should add. How are you? All well?
It's been a pretty decent weekend for myself and for you, I should imagine.
Yeah, you know, like the 12:30 kickoff is both a blessing and a curse. If you win in the 12:30 kickoff, your whole weekend's untouchable. It's great. Obviously, if you lose, your whole weekend's a downer. But I mean, you know, that's the risk. That's the risk you play.
It certainly is. And to be fair, the early kickoff didn't just please yourself on this podcast. So I must admit.
Oh, yes, I imagine. It lit up Wigan Towers early on. I mean, you were probably still coming in from your Friday night by the time it kicked off, but
I was out Friday, but I had to behave myself because and my girlfriend over for the weekend, and it was an interesting one actually because she's a Tottenham fan, so
mixed
emotions in our Wigan Towers this weekend.
Ah, well, she'll have to sleep in the spare wing at this rate, so.
Very true.
Well, on that note, let's start with that early kickoff, which is the mighty, mighty Magpies 4, Tottenham Hotspur 0. I mean, this couldn't have gone any better for me or you, as you alluded to in the intro there. A bit of a scrappy start, probably fair to say, but then once Newcastle got the opening goal, Tottenham imploded. Newcastle played well throughout, I thought, but Tottenham didn't help themselves at all. Alexander Isaac helped himself to a couple. Anthony Gordon got his now customary St. James's Park goal. And Fabian Schär rounded off the score and laid on with a header from a corner. And honestly, we could have scored about 10 from corners alone. Tottenham were incapable of defending those all afternoon. I could wax lyric about us all day. Did you see enough of this to form an opinion? Or?
I saw the first half and then... Yeah, we went out for the afternoon, so I had to watch the rest in portions on Match of the Day throughout the rest of the weekend. Being very careful about when to turn that TV on. Yeah, you're right. The sort of opening, well, maybe 15 minutes or so. I thought Tottenham started reasonably well, but unfortunately for them and fortunately for yourselves, the bulk of their chances fell to Timo Werner, who, you know, it still irks me that he scored against us when we played them the other week, but he's not a natural finisher, and I think that's probably the kindest way to describe it. And, you know, Mickey van der Ven, the quickest player on earth, who's been outstanding, apparently, for Tottenham all season, was given the big sell by the insightful pundit that was Rio Ferdinand before the game, saying he can go all the way to the top, and he had a bit of a stinker, didn't he, Dave?
Well, he kept falling over, which is probably lesson one of defending is not to fall over. I mean, Isaac had him on toast, I think it's probably fair to say. And there's always a degree of, like, well, he's been a bit unlucky there when he slipped, but I'm not certain he slipped in, like, the traditional way when, you know, the surface is a bit slippy. Like, he just seemed to really just have no balance whatsoever. Like, it was really quite something.
I mean, normally when you see a player slip, you rarely see them sort of launch into a breakdance routine as well.
which
you managed to do on more than one occasion in the space of 2 minutes.
It was really quite something. In the first goal, as you say, he was left for dead. The second goal happened 18 seconds after the kickoff, which is an incredible feat of foolishness from Tottenham. Pedro Porro didn't say misplacing a back pass, he just didn't realise other players were on the pitch, I think. And as you say, Van de Ven went flying and Gordon effectively killed the game there and then. It was definitely killed just after half time when Isaac scored from a lovely ball over the top when everyone in the world thought it was offside, but craftily starting his own half, such as Spurs' high defensive line, which has been a talking point all season. And you watch like yourselves play a high defensive line and capture the opposition a half offside multiple times. Tottenham not so good at that.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how I see it, you know, sort of describing Tottenham's defensive line. But that seems to be at odds with every pundit going. So, I mean, who's right, Dave? You know, the experts who say that it's genius football, or, you know, the peasants like yourselves and me, who see them get exposed time and time again doing it. You know, I'm sure time will tell on that. But, it was one of those like, from obviously, from sort of my point of view, like, I've sort of taken a bit of an interest, obviously, in Tottenham's fixtures in recent weeks and the upcoming ones, because we're in that battle with them for fourth. But I looked at their sort of fixture list, starting with the game against yourselves on the weekends, and it did and it didn't surprise me in a way, like, because obviously Newcastle have had a bit of a stuttering season, but you seem sick, so I don't know if that's a fair analysis. So I didn't necessarily think that Tottenham would. I was going to say, I didn't think they would go and lose there, but it's exactly the type of game that Tottenham would go lose and get battered in. It seems like every sort of four or five games, they go away from home and do something like this. And yourself and I were discussing last week when I was sort of waxing lyrical about Ollie Watkins, spoiler alert, more on him later. and you quite rightly sort of threw Isak into the mix when I was on about, you know, Watkins being the second best proper centre forward, and I think we both kind of agreed that Isak is absolutely quality. The only sort of negative he had really was his injury record, but when he's fit and firing, you know, he's such a class act, isn't he?
I was really surprised to see him on 17 league goals, and not to do down his quality, but I just feel like he's missed so many games. And obviously we haven't been fantastic in a chunk of the season, shall we say. So he's doing incredibly well. He doesn't miss many chances, to be fair. I mean, obviously, you know, we haven't been at our fluid best all season, really, but this is the first game where Howe's been able to play Barnes, Gordon and Isaac as a three. Which is incredible, considering it's April.
Did Barnes start?
Yeah, Barnes from the left, Gordon from the right, and Isak through the middle. And, I mean, I wouldn't say they were unplayable, but certainly Gordon and Isak have got a really good understanding and give Tottenham a torrid time. And what I like about Barnes, is although he didn't score, like, you always feel like he could score. He always gets a chance or a couple of chances in a game because his movement's very good in the top end of the pitch. So it's just nice that if we can get those three on the field a lot next season, I think we'll obviously do even better. I hope.
I rate Harvey Barnes.
I do. Yeah, I like him a lot.
I mean, when he was at Leicester, he's kind of, I kind of didn't like him, but only from the point of view that he's one of many, many players on this list that always seem to score against Villa. but he's one of those wingers. You know, sometimes you see like a winger that they can torment their left back who they're up against, the, you know, real bag of tricks. there's very little end products. Barnes is kind of like
the opposite.
From what I've seen of him, which, you know, obviously really mainly only highlights over the last sort of couple of seasons, he's not someone that's that you think is going to pick the ball up, skin two or three players, and then put it on the plate for someone. But he's just pure end product. What you want, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I couldn't have put it about myself. He's basically a direct replacement for Alan Saint-Maximin, who was a fan favourite, but didn't necessarily always have the end product, which...
They're the complete opposites of each other, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think was ever a huge fan of Saint-Maximin. Obviously, he sold him. But he wasn't really a system player like Eddie Howe would want him to be, and he was more of a, you know, a game changer, a bit of a maverick off the bench every now and again. And when Barnes was bought, I think we all, you know, anyone who'd seen football could tell you that he wants someone who's going to get on the end of crosses from the other side of the pitch rather than perhaps someone who's going to, you know, Sam Maxman has his positives, don't get us wrong, and he was great to watch, but he probably did more for himself than he did for the team, it's probably fair to say. Not necessarily on purpose, just the way he is, you know.
Yeah.
He could beat players inside out all day, but didn't always have the finish to go with it. So yeah, I'm hoping to see a lot more of Barnes next season, because I think he broke his foot about a month into his time with us, and it's obviously affected things quite a bit.
Yeah, the only sort of thing that that sort of stood out from this game as well. Have I missed a new rule that means James Maddison will not get sent off even if he punches or kicks people?
It's bizarre, isn't it? Like, I mean, he wasn't as much of an arsehole when he was at Leicester, I don't think. I mean, he always had a bit of an edge to him, but like, in this game, obviously, like, he was lucky not to get booked for the blatant body check in the, whatever it was, 10, 15 minutes, whatever it was. But then for him to have the same thing done to him by Dan Byrne, and have the temerity to basically plead with the ref, like, what you're playing at for not booking him, like, it takes an incredible amount of, what's the word, like, lack of self-awareness.
Yeah,
are you watching the Chelsea game at the minute, by the way?
I am, yes.
What are these idiots doing? Like, Chelsea got a pen, and like four of them have been like fighting each other for the ball, off the man who never misses. Like, shut up, Jackson.
Chelsea. I mean, even at 4-0 up, they can still be hilarious. And Madison. He at Villa, we've always thought he was an arsehole, and that's just more of a personal thing, because he's a Coventry boy, Coventry fan, and they absolutely hate us. I mean, they don't flick on our radar, but they despise Villa. So he, again, like Barnes, always seems to score at Villa Park, and to be fair, quite rightly enjoys it, because I'm one of those people, if you're going to dish out abuse as a fan base, you've got to take it back. But yeah, how he's not been sent off in the last 2 weeks is beyond bizarre.
Yeah, it's very odd. I was also very surprised. I'm sure he took the captain's armband at one point in this game towards the end. I was like, well, that doesn't surprise me. That is incredible. But anyway, bad weekend for Tottenham. Before we move on, do you feel? I mean, I've been getting very, you know, at this time of the season, we start looking at the fixtures. We are 10 points behind Tottenham at the moment, which is a big deficit this time of the season. But four of Tottenham's last six are Chelsea away, they are Arsenal, they are Liverpool, they are Man City. That's four games that if they play like this, they're not going to win.
Yes.
Tottenham don't play next weekend because of reasons. Whereas we play, you know, we play Palace away. And then we play Sheffield United at home. So by the time they next play, we could be 4 points behind them. And they go to Chelsea. You see where I'm going with this, right?
I do, yes.
Do you think it's possible that we could catch and overtake Tottenham in the last six games?
I mean, it's normally, as you think, you look at 10 points of six games and think that would take some doing to like overtake that. But Tottenham are like one of a handful of teams. Like you could see it happening. Like it would be the definition probably of Spursley for fifth place to get an extra Champions League spot, and they blow it from here. I mean, can I actually say you reel off those the fixtures that they've got? You can easily see them dropping, but not necessarily losing. Not necessarily not winning at least one, but you can see them dropping a decent number of points. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. I think it'll be a tough ask, and like you're talking about a proper meltdown from Tottenham. But as you say, if you get those couple of wins before they play again, you're at the stage of the season now where points on the board are a lot more valuable than games in hand.
Yes, yeah. I think it's obviously a long shot that it could happen, but as we'll come on to later on, I think scoreboard pressure, whatever you want to call it, can become a real factor at this time of the season when people get a bit nervy looking over the shoulder. And if we can put some pressure on them,
I'd be
interested to see how they respond. But anyway, that's for me to get excited about at a later date. Let's go on to the Saturday 3 o'clock. Where should we cover off? So Brentford beat Sheffield United 2-0, and no one's surprised when Sheffield United lose a game of football. Brentford hadn't won for a long time, and then Brentford did win. Do you have anything great to say about this? Because, I mean, I don't really recall an awful lot about this. Tony was benched, and I think I do wonder if Thomas Frank has said, well, you quite clearly don't want to be here. We're probably not going to go down. Should we just start playing our people who want to be here?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, cause, I mean, well, he started on the bench against us last weekend. So I think he'd had like a little injury or something, so he was on the bench. But then I think at the end of the game, there was like
he was having a disagreement
with Nathan Collins, I think it was. To be fair, like those things happen, but it's kind of one of those that if you hadn't been any other player than Tony, maybe like having the agreement with Collins, you kind of maybe write it off. But considering, as you say, quite clearly doesn't want to be there. You know, he's given a number of interviews since coming back after a self-inflicted absence that the club's, you know, went overboard by standing by him, and it's like the first couple of interviews he's basically hauling himself around for the summer, and even before then, as you know, said on a number of occasions quite disrespectful things about Brentford. So yeah, the guy's in that just thinking he's not gonna be here, we're not gonna go down. There could be something in that.
Maybe. Or as you say, he might just be still recovering from that injury, but just thought it was odd because, as you say, he's been the main man there for so long. They're going to have to get used to life without him at some point, I suppose. But I think he's a bit of an arsehole, to be honest, by all accounts. I think there's a few sort of well-connected Arsenal accounts who've said they were very keen to buy him, but then actually, as they've got to kind of know him, they've just said he's an arsehole. He's not worth the hassle. So.
Yeah, exactly. And probably the money that Brentford... Well, it's an interesting one because he's only got a year left on his deal, hasn't he?
I think he'll be looking to get 40 million from now.
This is it. Like they'll obviously want a decent price for him. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with him, actually, because also, like, where would he go? Like, I'm not sure. He'll end up in Man U, won't he?
Well, I thought he might go to Chelsea, but... I mean, Jackson
doesn't fit their model, though, does he?
Well, what is their model, though?
Children.
Children who can be sold for a greater price. I think it's hard to say. Like, I think when he wasn't playing, he sort of got better in people's eyes, and now he's come back, and he's done all right. He's done all right, having been out for so long. But You saw the chance he missed against Man United the other week. Like,
yeah,
the chances you wouldn't necessarily expect a 50, 60 million pound striker to miss.
Do you think the other thing as well, like you say, Chelsea, he's whatever this move, wherever he goes, you know, if he goes to summer, it's probably like it would be the sort of only big move. You know, if he's going to move to a big club, it's this one, isn't it? It's not going to go somewhere and then go somewhere else after that.
Yeah, he's got one shot at it, really.
So is he going to use that one shot at a club that will not be playing European football next season and, you know, don't look necessarily like they're going to be challenging anywhere near the top four next season? I think it's a strange one, actually, where I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens with him over the summer and where he ends up.
Yeah, I think there should be quite a few sagas this summer which need to be played out, and they've been threatened for a long time, but hopefully this summer is a summer of actual interest. I think we've had quite a quiet few transfer windows recently, but hopefully that'll come to an end this year. Burnley 1, Brighton 1. Again, not a tremendous game, but what's wrong with Burnley's goalkeepers?
Oh my God. I mean, mate, we've been kind of been fairly critical of Trafford all season, quite rightly. Maybe we're seeing why they've been behind him. Like, you think Trafford's bad, you should see the chump he's behind him. Like, gee, I mean, the one last week was, you know, obviously really bad. But, like, every now and again, those kind of things do happen. They shouldn't, but, like, you do kind of see a stupid goal like that. But the one on the weekend was, I mean, that was just ridiculous. Like, I don't know how you can. I know Craig Bellamy did his best to try and defend our match of the day, but that was awful, wasn't it?
It was nearly as bad as Craig Bellamy's post-match analysis, where he said, "My three-year-old daughter still believes in rainbows and unicorns, and maybe I'm a dreamer, but I believe in them too."
Oh God! Oh, Craig! So, rainbows. I'm not saying anything at all.
Yeah, rainbows, of course, not real. So, stupid man.
Oh God. Yeah, I mean, what? I don't. Yeah, there's nothing really more you can say about Burnley, and I mean, Brighton's just. I mean, they've not hit the heights of last season, but I don't.
They're just.
Were they ever going to?
They're just shagged out, aren't they? They've played too many games. Change the team every week. I think, obviously, it seems almost certain that De Zerbi's going to leave in the summer. I'm not overly sure he's worthy of the buy-ins and Liverpool he's been linked with. He plays a nice brand of football, but he's fundamentally taken Brighton to 10th and the last 16 in Europe in the Europa League. Like, it's not exactly shit the bed great, is it? But I guess he is the flavour of the week. If enough people say it, then it's true. So, we'll see.
Yeah, it's kind of still living off, like, the, you know, what they did last season was brilliant. They were, you know, really good to watch. But you can't keep going back to last season, you know, when what you're seeing in front of hasn't been the same. But the only, I suppose, thing is with them as well, the last few years, the sort of model has been, you know, they unearth these gems, you know, they'll get these good, you know, younger players and they sell them off for big money, which is all well and good. And you kind of, you think, oh God, that's a really good, clever strategy. But there's been so many teams over the years that kind of, sort of in a way, do that, sell one really good player a year. But there's only so long that you can. You keep going, you know, Southampton.
Yeah, it always catch up eventually, doesn't it?
That kind of stage, yeah. Leicester. I mean, even going way back ourselves, I remember we had three summers in a row where we lost Barry the one summer, Milner the year after that, Ashley Young the year after that. Like, you can't, you're sort of in that bracket of, say, 6th, 7th to 11th, 12th. you're not going to be able to keep doing that year on year. Eventually, like you just said, it will catch up on you. And I'm not saying that's necessarily what's like definitely happened to Brighton, but you kind of, you can almost see the early signs of that.
You wouldn't be surprised. I mean, as you say, the problem with that kind of strategy is that every decision you make has got to be spot on. Yes. Or else, as you see with Southampton, you know, they, when they went down, they made the season before they went down, they made the choice to buy young players, and they spent quite a lot of money on, you know, Bazunu and a multitude of other young Man City cast-offs, basically. And it was too much for them, and it didn't work, and obviously they got relegated. And, I mean, all right, they're making a fist to come back, fair play to them, but it's not always sustainable. And if you get one decision wrong, whether it be the manager or whether it be the players you bring in, you end up in this situation. So we'll see what happens to Brighton. Obviously, I think, as we said, De Zerbi's almost certainly going to depart this summer. Who they bring in next, I wonder, remains to be seen, because it's obviously got a very specific brand of football they like to play, which, again, fair play to them, that's their deal. But it's got to be the right choice, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, though, you kind of, you do get the feeling with Brighton from that sort of point of view, like as from the managerial point of view, you sort of feel that they've probably got already, or, you know, when they appointed De Zerbi, they probably then drew up a list of four or five names to come after him. But as you say, that doesn't, you know, it's not as easy. Football isn't as easy and simple as that, is it?
Well, the only difference is, of course, Dan Ashworth was there when they had those decisions to make. Yes. I don't know who's replaced him. I'm obviously, someone will have replaced him, but are they working from the same list? Who knows? I mean, I guess we'll find out, but it should be an interesting summer anyway at Brighton if that happens. This should be bigger news, really, but I mean, Man City won 5-1 to return to the top of the Premier League. I mean, this was a result that was never in doubt. I think most people would have predicted Man City and at least four, I think, it's probably fair to say. it was only ever in, I wasn't in doubt, really, but there was obviously quite a long time between goals. But eventually the floodgates opened and Man City eventually broke down that shattered Luton defence, which was full of wingers for some reason. Do you have anything to add on this? I mean, I say the sort of the bigger headlines in the title race came on Sunday. This was just as you'd expect.
Yeah, I mean, actually, like from the highlights that I saw, like, I mean, Luton did an awful lot wrong, but you just, like you said, you know, sort of a bit of a patched-up team that they're having to pull out, and they're playing against a group of players that are vastly superior to them. Like, it's one of those games that, from a Luton point of view, you go in there just, you know, hoping for a miracle to pull something off, but probably accepting what's going to happen. And Man City, as you've been saying, you know, from ever since the turn of the year, they're just in that mode, aren't they, where they just reel off these victories and just put these teams away. And yeah, I don't think anyone like saw anything different happening in this game than what ended up happening.
No, but I do feel a degree of sympathy for, is it Hashioga, the Luton centre half, who everything he touches turns to shit, and like, it's not really his fault, he just seems to be in the wrong place at the wrong time all the time. So another own goal for him. He nearly got concussed as well, scoring this own goal. So, poor him. An entertaining game took place at Nottingham Forest 2, Wolves 2. Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
How and why are Morgan Gibbs-White and Matheus Cunha friends? How has that happened?
I'm not sure. Has Cunha been at Wolves for long?
No, well, he hasn't been there whilst Gibbs-White hasn't been there, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
All I can think of is like something ludicrous, like Gibbs-White has sold him his house or something when he's moved in. I just don't understand how else their paths would have crossed, but I'm sure there's a reason. But those two spent the game mocking each other, basically. And it finished 2-2 in the end. A result that probably doesn't really help Forest in their fight against relegation. I mean, obviously all points are vital, but this probably would be encircled as a potential one for all three.
I suppose I'm just looking at their remaining fixtures. Other than they've got Man City at home at the end of April, other than that, they've got Everton away, Sheffield United away, Chelsea at home, which is their last home game, and then they finish at Burnley away. So they've not got terrible running, but you're right, this is a game, obviously, I'm sure they will have definitely be earmarked as, you know, they're certainly a winnable to get all 3 points, especially knowing that Luton were away at Man City. So now they're probably, you know, going into that game, probably, you know, pretty much betting Luton to not pick up anything. So it's a chance to pull 3 points clear of Luton with the win. Missed opportunity. And, you know, again, sort of going back to the point I'd make about Brighton having managers lined up, it's not as simple as that. And you're looking at that fixture list and you think, okay, yeah, there's three or four winnable games in there, but there's a reason Nottingham Forest are down where they are on the table is because they don't win many football games. So I'm sure, having come back from one behind to go 2-1 up, they'll be disappointed with this missed opportunity. But I thought Cunha's first goal, really, really lucky.
Unbelievable. Yeah, he's... I mean, I said earlier in the season, you probably don't agree with them being Wolves, but when Wolves had Cunha, Neto and Hwang all fit and available, I thought they were an excellent watch. I really enjoyed, as a neutral, some of their games earlier in the season. Unfortunately, I think they've all had injuries since then, but when the three of them were on, they were really fun to watch, and Wolves haven't been fun to watch at all during their time in the Premier League.
I totally agree. I mean, for the vast majority of the season, sort of been quite effusive in my praise for Gary O'Neill and the job that they've done there. And you're right, I mean, Neto, we've kind of all on this podcast spoken on a number of occasions about what a fantastic player he is, but in the same way, when you talk about Isak, his hamstrings are made of cheese strings, aren't they? He's just never, ever fit. Cunha, really good player. Hwang, I thought he was decent last season. He gets a good amount of goals. And yeah, when the three of them are on it, they do play really good football. The problem that they've got with number of teams in that sort of middle pack of the league is, if you have one or two injuries to those key players, the drop in quality from them to people coming in, it's so vast that you're never going to get the same performances.
Yeah, that seems to be the case for Wolves. Obviously, losing all three at the same time really stopped their season in its tracks, really. I mean, they've still got an outside chance of finishing in the top eight, but things are not really going for them at the minute. So, Gary O'Neill always has something to complain about. I don't think he did this week, did he? But he usually has something to twist about.
I can't recall anything that annoyed him this week. Which, I mean, to be fair, is one of the few weeks that they didn't have a horrendous season go their way. Like, the majority of his complaints, I think, have been quite bad.
Yes, I think they have had the opposite of the rubber of the green. I don't know what that would be, but when they say that even not over a season, they haven't, I don't think, for Wolves. but never mind. They're safe, which is far better than most of us expect them to be this time of the season.
100%.
So fair play to Gary O'Neill and the gang. Right, are you ready for the latest chapter of how Man United played this shit and not lost again? So they drew 2-2 with Bournemouth, having trailed 1-0 and 2-1. Bruno Fernandes stroked home what I think is a controversial penalty in a way, but he does move his arm a bit towards the ball, I suppose, but it just didn't feel right. But yeah, basically, Bournemouth should have been out of sight, really, in the first half. They had numerous chances, which they didn't take. And Man United got their equaliser, and then there was some injury time controversy where do you want to start? Do you want to do the penalty that was given first?
Yeah, why not? I mean, as we were just talking about Wolves having everything go against them, I think do you know what's happening? You know, they said even things out over the season. Obviously, the very first one that Wolves had against them was at Old Trafford, wasn't it, on the opening day?
Yes.
And I think the football gods got confused about which team had the harsh decision. And so they've evened everything out for Wolves, but they've accidentally evened it all out for Manchester United over the season. Some of the decisions they get, I mean, that the penalty that they got, I think that is, I think it's a scandalous decision to give that penalty. Honestly, I thought it was horrific.
I'm surprised, seeing it real time, I thought, there's no way they'll give a pen for that. And then obviously when they slow it down, you say, well, I suppose he does move his arm towards the ball a little bit and he's not close to the ball. But like, it's travelling at some speed.
See, I don't think that I'd agree that he moves his arm towards the ball. I think it's just a natural movement of his arm as the ball's flying at him. Because, as you say, you watch it in real time, it's coming at some speed and it's taken a huge deflection as well. I honestly don't believe that in that split seconds he's decided to try and swing an arm out for it, because why would you? I think it just hit his arm. Because players aren't statues, you stand perfectly still. Like, as you're walking or running about, your arm does move. Like, it doesn't stay still as you move. It's one of those, again, there's no way of proving it, but there's no way that he's given against Man U.
I'll go along with that. You have to remind me, did the ref give the decision on the field and it just wasn't overturned?
Or he did, yeah.
Well, I don't think that would have been given had it not been given on the pitch. I don't think VAR would have upgraded it.
I
haven't said that, it's Man U, isn't it? So maybe they would have.
This is it, yeah. That's at the other end, I'd agree. But honestly, I think because I don't care what Howard Webb and all of them come out and say about there's no such thing as a bite. Like, that is just bollocks. Everyone knows that is not true. I honestly thought it was ridiculous. And they probably would have intervened and given it to them because it's Man U.
I can't believe more hasn't been made. Can you remember at the start of the season when Mike Dean was, I know he's obviously retired now, but he was casually like, I didn't upgrade that in the VAR because it didn't upset me, mate.
Yes.
Like, I can't believe more hasn't been made of that, because that's a scandalous thing to say.
Yeah.
From, like, what was the most senior ref in the Premier League at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, if that's his philosophy, I'm sure some of the others have got the same philosophy.
100%.
And I find that absolutely insane. Because that's basically like admitting that you didn't do your job because you didn't want to upset your pal, which... In any other line of work, would not end well for you.
Yeah, and like I don't know who was the on-field ref and who was the VAR for this one, but you've heard stuff about if the referee is on the VAR is the more inexperienced, you know, if he's not as experienced as the on-field one, that they feel like, well, they're the on-field, you know, they've got more experience on field, so I'm not going to question their judgment. Like, that has to seep into it. It doesn't matter, you know, that can even be like a subconscious thing, you know, you're not necessarily be going out to, you know, to not sort of believe in your own ability and stand up for yourself. But there will be certain things, you know, if you're like a young ref who's only done, say, 20-odd games in the Premier League, and the on-field ref has done over 100, there will be some part of you, whether you realise it or not, who will think, well, he probably knows a bit more than me, so I'm not necessarily going to question that. Yeah, I thought that was a bad one. And then you had the injury time one, which...
Yeah, no, obviously the ref gives this one on the field, and they say the foul is outside the box, so it's been overturned. Now, we always get told if the foul starts outside the box and continues into the box, it is a penalty, except when it's against Man United. That's the only logic I can conclude from this, because to me, the foul goes on long into the penalty area.
Yes.
And somehow they've concluded that it doesn't. Like, I just... it's a bad one.
Yeah. It's horrific. And, you know, I keep going back. And again, there's no way of proving it. But if that's the other end, you're telling me that they'll overturn that. I don't believe that they would. You know, you're right. There's no doubting that the first initial contact is outside the box. And he continues to hold on and rugby tackles him inside the box. You know, it's no different to when you see, was it your game against Luton, the mad 4-4 a few weeks ago, where
Dan Burn
had his shirt outside the box. And you've seen that happen quite a few times when they grab hold the shirt outside and then continue holding in. You get the penalty. So I cannot... Is there any difference between that and this? You know, I can't see it. And there's supposed to be this whole a clear and obvious error. Again, I don't see how that had met the thresholds to overturn that decision. Did the ref even go and have a look at it?
No, they just told it was outside the box, and that was that, I think.
See, yeah. Again, you kind of think, yeah, no one's disputing the initial contact is outside. Surely on that, you tell the ref to go have a look and say, you know, he initially gets hold of him outside the box. Do you want to have a look at it to see whether in your mind you think that he's continued to commit that foul inside the box? It's just a ridiculous decision that has somehow yet again gone in Man United's favour.
A bizarre one. But as you said, also not unexpected from the way refereeing decisions have gone since 1992, pretty much.
But I do enjoy that they've now dropped down to seventh.
Yeah, I mean, after my bluster about us potentially finishing fifth, I fully expect to finish below Manchester United. But they're awful, absolutely abysmal every game they play, and somehow find themselves still in the European places. They subbed Garnacho at half time here because Ten Hag didn't feel like he was working hard enough or something. Who really knows? But that was him hung out to dry anyway. So we'll see if he ends up the same way as Sancho and being farmed out.
An accusation of him not working hard enough is something that I can absolutely 100% well believe.
Well, that's it. I mean, you won't ever pick on the senior players, but give him a chance to shout at some young children, and he certainly will. I mean, honestly, I mean, not to labour the point, but Man United was so poor in this first half. Like, the amount of times that Bournemouth were able to just pick holes through their entire team, pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, was it? I think it was Match of the Day. Show the stats. Only Sheffield United have faced more shots than Man U this season.
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible, really, that they are where they are. You know, I think there's all this talk about, you know, Ten Hag needs to go. They need to get, you know, the lead manager in and all this. I think the conversation should be reframed. The fact he's got that squad of players as high as seventh, I think he's actually done a fantastic job.
Well, I hope he stays forever. But
oh, God, yeah.
I certainly won't, but never mind. On to Sunday then, and the big game, of course, West Ham 0, Fulham 2. obviously, just want to get this one out of the way, really. West Ham, I'm expecting this season to sort of fizzle out now. Europa League looks like a bit of a bust game, unless they can perform a miracle and beat undefeated by Leverkusen.
Yeah, they're so strange, because if they'd have won yesterday, they'd be sitting sixth.
I know, it's mad, isn't it? I mean they have played a game more, but it's a strange one. Because I feel like West Ham fans have just had enough of David Moyes, despite, you know, all the success they've had with him, and they've become a regular in the top eight under him, which couldn't be said the same of many of their previous managers. But either way, seems like his time will be up at the end of the season. Anything on this game in particular? I mean, I don't have an awful lot to say about it. Fulham continue to bemuse everybody. Like,
yeah, I mean, you got two teams that you kind of scratch your heads every other week looking at the results of these two teams, thinking, how's this what happens? Like, yeah, two very strange football teams. But you say Fulham. I think a few people, myself included, not necessarily maybe thought they'd go down, but certainly thought they'd have a bit of a struggle this season, obviously with Mitrovic moving on. But they've done pretty well, to be fair. I think considering probably what the expectations were going into the season, there's this sort of classic mid-table team. But whereas, say, Crystal Palace, although we might have to start changing our opinion on them, where your mid-table team that you kind of were just boring to watch. Fulham, at least, they're your mid-table team, but when they're good, they're really, really good. But when they're bad, you know, they're awful as well.
Yeah. It's an enigma of a season. It's Marco Silva in a nutshell, isn't it? Like, when he's good, he's great. Yeah. When he's bad, they're awful. But never mind. So, two big games in the title race took place. Liverpool v Crystal Palace. I think most people expect Liverpool to win this relatively comfortably, given the respective place in the league table. Anything but, and Crystal Palace ran out 1-0 winners. You can't really argue they didn't deserve it. I think they had as many chances as Liverpool. I know Liverpool missed a few late on, but Palace missed a lot in the first half. It could have been any score, really.
Yeah. I don't think anyone before the game would have necessarily predicted that result. And sort of the highlights, watching them, you can almost say Palace deserved to win and could have scored more, but Liverpool probably shouldn't have lost with, you know, some of the chances, especially late on, that they had. But it's not been a good couple of weeks for Liverpool, has it? Really? And
no.
Palace. Yeah, as we've said like a few times, a team that you rarely, really notice. But I thought they were, from sort of the highlights I saw, I thought they were really, really good.
They were phenomenal in the first half in particular. So, like, some of the passing and movement was just out of this world. Obviously, the goal
was great.
The goal came about 24 passes, I think they said, which is obviously no mean feat. They could have scored more. In the end, Liverpool obviously came on stronger and stronger as the game went on, but missing so many chances. Obviously, the Jota had an open goal which was blocked on the line. Curtis Jones went through 3-on-1, I guess you could say, and just contrived to pass it wide of the goal, which was pretty special. Obviously, Salah had a little toe poke at the end, which was blocked. Multiple other chances we could talk about all day, but just didn't go in with Liverpool. What's gone wrong for Liverpool? Do you think it's finally caught up with them, because they've kind of been skating by a lot this season, but just too many games?
Yeah, I think what they've sort of had all season is they've got very good forward options and quite a few of them, but they have been, I think, vulnerable defensively all season. You've been able to get at them, and the midfield was, there's some good players in there. It's a brand new midfield really that they're trying to rebuild. And the players at the moment are just, they're not of the quality of when you had Fabinho, Henderson, as much maligned as he has been. You know, there was a period of time where them two and, you know, might have Keita one week or, you know, someone else the other. That was a very good midfield three that worked together. And the current one they've got, it's, you know, there's some younger players in there, so they're trying to blend it together. And I think they've kind of been relying a lot on just having so many good forward options. And the way they play, you're going to create chances and get goals. But I think, I'm not sure, it might be last week or the other week when we were talking about the three sort of title chasers. I've described Liverpool as they're quite chaotic, and sometimes that's great and it can end up in a hatful of goals for them. But sometimes it can just go completely wrong. And rather than having that chaos, you want a bit of composure. I don't know if you saw any of the Monday Night Football earlier on today when Carragher was sort of going through clips of Liverpool over the last few weeks, and the amount of times that they kind of break on the opposition and will have like a 4-on-2 or 5-on-3 in their favour. And so Carragher is saying, if Man City are in those positions, you just back them to always pick that, you know, have that bit of composure to pick that right pass and, you know, at the right time. As you watch Liverpool, it's so chaotic. There's not that precision there at times. And, you know, you kind of saw that yesterday, especially towards the end of the game.
Yeah. It was pretty noticeable, really, how easy it was to get at them. There's a bigger game to talk about, though, which came at the Emirates. Arsenal 0, Aston Villa 2, obviously much to your delight.
Yes.
Probably even more to Manchester City's delight. It couldn't have gone any better for Manchester City this weekend with these results. This game, Arsenal sort of came on strong, but never really dominated the game. And Villa always looked a threat on the break. In the second half, I thought Villa were outstanding. Didn't let Arsenal get into the stride at all, and obviously got the rewards with two goals. How did you see it, Si? Obviously, one of the best results of the season for yourselves. How did you do it?
Another sort of Unai Emery masterclass with the game plan, really. I agree. I think Arsenal obviously started the game very strong, as you know they've done for quite a while this season, especially at home. And I thought the first half an hour, 35 minutes, they played some great football. There were some really lovely sort of passages of play from them. But like sort of looking back at the game afterwards, I saw Arteta talking about how they could have been 3 or 4 nil up at half time. But I think they only really had one proper chance that they should have scored, which was the Trossard one, really. Yeah. And other than that, I can't actually think of any actual chances they had where you say, oh, maybe we got away with it or something. And, you know, the Trossard one, he should bury it. There's no doubt about that. But when you're up against the best keeper in the world, these things can happen, can't they? So, yeah, and then from Villa's point of view, everyone's sort of talked about how great we were in the second half, which we were. But I think it started before that. The last sort of 10-15 minutes of that first half, you could see that we were gaining a bit of a foothold in the game. And, you know, the tactics that we employed in terms of playing out from the back, it's a risk, obviously, you know, doing that. But we're so well drilled that when we're on it, they're absolutely excellent at it, and they have full belief in the system. And, you know, McGinn and Tiedemans, I thought were outstanding yesterday. They sort of always drop in deep to give options to want to get on the ball and receive it under pressure. And as I said, the first half was going on, I thought that we were sort of getting back into it. And the second half, I thought we just completely controlled that second half, to be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, you could sort of see that, I think it was maybe about 10 minutes or so into the second half, where we were sort of playing out, sort of passing it around at the back. And I'm not going to lie, at times I sort of, my heart was in my mouth thinking, oh Christ, this is risky. Because Arsenal do press really, really well, and they're very aggressive with it. But there was a couple of occasions where we played out of it and got it into Tielemans or McGinn in the midfield, so all of a sudden had acres of space, and you could almost see a shift in the whole stadium, really. You could almost feel that their fans were getting a little edgy. Our fans were sort of getting a bit more giddy, and it translated to the players. And then I think bringing Leon Bailey on was a real big changer for us as well, because he's had such a great season. And within a couple of minutes of him getting on, he was skinning Zinchenko, and you could see them sort of getting a bit worried. I'll be honest, when Tiedemans somehow managed to hit the bar and post with the one shot, I was thinking, is that our chance gone? But then, I mean, when we went 1-0 up, I thought I was over the moon at 1-0, and then a couple of minutes later, we go and get the second. And it was just, as I say, it was a masterclass of an away performance, really. I think over the course of this Premier League season, there's an argument to say that Villa, out of all the teams, have put in the single best attacking performance when we beat Man City, and the single best defensive performance in that game yesterday. Diego Carlos was superb. I've been very critical of him. I've expected a lot more of him this season. I thought he was great yesterday. And Morgan Rogers as well.
He was very good, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot of Villa fans in January very vocal on social media with their complaints about why we signing a championship 21-year-old. And my opinion was very much, if Unai Emery thinks he's good enough and wants to sign him, I'll go along with him. And yeah, he's growing week by week. And to go to the Emirates with no Douglas Luiz or Kamara in that midfield, and McGinn and Tiedemans to do what they did, it was just an outstanding performance and perfect way to round off the weekend for myself, really.
I bet, yeah. I thought two things really about Arsenal. I thought Gabriel and Saliba, who have been superb all season, looked all at sea all game. I thought Ollie Watkins had them on edge, which, I mean, he obviously does with his pace, but generally they didn't look comfortable all game. Wasn't good at all from them too. I mean, they weren't great against Bayern Munich either. I mean, I don't know whether that's like a hangover from that, whether they'd been shut up a bit, for want of a better term, because obviously Bayern played well and obviously have got pace to burn all over the field, more or less, and they didn't seem comfortable playing against that whatsoever. I think Gabriel would much rather play against Erling Haaland, someone he can sort of bully a bit, that sort of striker, whereas didn't seem comfortable at all here with Watkins. And also I thought Arteta, I don't know whether he took a liberty with his team selection or whether he just felt he had to freshen it up again after the Bayern Munich game, but he didn't play Kivior, he played Zinchenko, who, Kivior, not a natural left-back, but more of a defender, and I thought Zinchenko was woeful. Not playing Jorginho, again, might be an age thing, playing two games in 4 days, but him not being in there meant that Rice was more subdued, and obviously Havertz was playing deeper and such like. And add to that, obviously, I think Havertz has been playing as a striker most of the good run they've had, and he's been outstanding, which I didn't ever expect to say, because I thought he'd been and gone. but he's come back strong. But for all Gabriel de Jesus is a winning runner, I don't think he is as good as he used to be. And I think in a big game, Havertz has routinely come up with a good playing as a centre forward. And obviously didn't have that yesterday. So I thought Arteta got it wrong. I said, I don't know how much of that was choice and how much of it was down to sort of aging, aching limbs, but I thought those decisions didn't help. But after the game started, I thought Villa were the better team, ultimately. So that's the way it played out.
Yeah, I mean, on the Arsenal sort of changes, I think... I mean, obviously, some of them, you know, they've got an eye. But I think they definitely had one eye on the Bayern Munich game in midweek, which...
I can't see the logic in that. I mean, I don't doubt that's what it is, but, like, if you're Arsenal and you're six games away, if you win, you're in. Six games, you win the Premier League.
Yeah.
With all due respect to them, they're probably not going to beat Man City over two legs if they stay off Bayern Munich. Like, I know they'll fancy the chances, but, like... It's Man City, like, but it's hard to beat them in one game and beat them over two legs. Like, get real. Like,
I agree. Yeah, you just I get obviously if you're team at the top end, you sort of fighting for things. You know, a couple of different competitions. Obviously, you've got a good squad of players because you wouldn't be up where you are if you didn't. And there is an element of rotation. But there is also, I think, at this stage of the season, I think just your immediate next game has to be your focus. And I kind of, like, part of me probably thinks as well, maybe an element, and God knows why you would do this, but an element of sort of underestimating who they were playing on Sunday. And there was an element of them thinking, well, these are played, you know, they've had a tough game and against Lille on Thursday night. They've got no Luiz or Kamara. We can probably change a couple of things and we'll see these off. Like, there seems to be just this element, especially after Liverpool losing. It felt like the sort of narrative is already written that, you know, Arsenal will relatively comfortably put these away. And, you know, they're playing against a team who are, I think, fourth in the league. So, you know, that why you would have that sort of my thought process, I do not know. But.
Well, I think we talked about it last week where, I mean, I certainly thought Arsenal would win purely because of who you were missing. I thought missing Kamara and Luiz against Arsenal. You know, Tielemans has been talked about, not the most mobile, probably fair to say. Him and McGinn together as a pair, I'm thinking... All right, sound technically probably, but yeah. I didn't really know if they had the legs to deal with it. They passed that test with flying colours, though. As you say, they were both superb. So, what the fuck do I know? Is what it boils down to.
Well, I mean, like, Tielemans has been a surprise in that. McGinn, would, you know, there's never any worries about that. With, you know, McGinn's just proper all energy to go along with his technical ability. Which I kind of think is a bit underrated by some people. I don't think people realise how good a technical player he actually is. But Tielemans, when we signed him, all we kind of heard from sort of like Leicester fans was, yeah, he's a good player, but you know, he's lazy. It's genuinely not been the case this season. He's obviously not as mobile as, you know, you might necessarily want from a central midfielder, which is probably why he spent most of his minutes when he has played this season sort of further up the pitch, not in that deeper role. But
yeah,
he, you know, played 90 minutes against Lille on Thursday. And so, yeah, I was kind of a little bit concerned, if I'm being brutally honest, going into that, thinking, will he have the legs in him? But like you say, he passed to Cesc with flying colours and lovely ball for Watkins' goal.
I did wonder if that was part of the reason why I left out Bailey from the start, because he played Rodgers, who was very narrow, I thought, for a lot of the game, almost to make a third in there. I don't know whether that was tactical or not, or whether it was just coincidental how it played out, but either way, it wasn't an issue for Villa. So centre midfield was all Villa for me. So fair play to Emery, gets it right again. Obviously nice for him to win at the Emirates as well after how he was treated there, which I think such a thing as a time machine. I do wonder if Arsenal would go back and maybe give him more than a season as Wenger's direct replacement. But hey ho,
exactly.
What's done is done.
Yeah, I'm sure if they had that time machine as well, they may have said, you know what, maybe let's not sell Emi Martinez.
But maybe, yeah, and Gnabry probably wouldn't loan him to West Brom. Probably give him a chance.
Many things.
So all of that has left Man City top of the table by 2 points. Can you see anything other than Man City winning the league now?
No, I mean, I just can't. I think last week when we were talking, I said, you know, I've said City all season, but last week I said that it wouldn't necessarily surprise me if Arsenal did, because I thought they were going to beat us yesterday, but I just think the way this weekend has gone, City winning and then both Liverpool and Arsenal dropping points in games, you'd probably earmark them to get all three. I can't see anything other than City waltzing it from here now.
No, maybe not. I mean, we've seen time and time again that they go on these runs at this time of the season where they'll just win and win and win. I've no doubt they will fancy the chance of winning all the remaining six. I mean, suppose potential bananas games, they've got Brighton next. Brighton have just talked about seem to be a bit of a busted flush, so I don't think I'll be losing any sleep over that one. They do have to play Tottenham away in their second last game of the season, which again, we've just talked about Tottenham. For whatever reason, Tottenham seem to have, I wouldn't say the Man City's bogey team by any means, but they've had more results against Man City than most have managed in recent times.
Yeah.
So maybe that's one shred of possibility there. But it's a massive swing. I mean, Man City have gone from probably being the outsiders to this title to firm favourites. And to be honest, there's every chance they're going to defend the treble, whilst also adding in the World Club Championship as well. So not a bad season after all, is it?
I mean, they've done all right, I suppose.
Haven't they just? But obviously, big game for them against Real Madrid on Wednesday night. Do you think they'll win? I think we'll knock out Real Madrid.
Yeah, I think they'll do the treble again. I really do.
I almost want them to, if it means that if it takes us a step closer to Pep going, you know what? I've had my fun. Because it's just, I mean, I'm sure they're having a wonderful time, but it is dull. Like,
yeah,
when they win everything, like if they can just win everything, and then he can leave. And then get their points deduction at some point, hopefully. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think winning one treble is, you know, that's bad enough for everyone else. If they were to do it again, surely just go, unless he fancies the treble, which has a nice ring to it, I suppose.
I suppose, yeah. Oh, well, just another season ago.
But yeah, it's like, kind of, you can't, they're so strange because it can be dull watching them, but in a way, it shouldn't be, because the level that they play at is, you know, something really we've not really seen, like in terms of doing it over so many years.
Yeah,
and,
oh,
it's, you know, last week I was saying, I think the title race will go to the last day with all three teams involved. Now I'm kind of thinking it will be done before the second last game of the season.
Well, the only sort of argument I can offer in favour of Arsenal, certainly, and Liverpool, I suppose, is that they both play twice before Man City play again. And if they can win both those games, obviously they'll put them top and indeed clear of Man City before they even kick a ball again in the Premier League. Now, whether that makes a shred of difference or not, I doubt. But if there is such a thing as scoreboard pressure, then that's where we're going to see it. Man City have got 4 away games out of 6 to finish with, which again probably won't matter. But
this is it.
All these things have got to be sort of crumbs of comfort that those two can take from this.
Well, yeah, like, you know, we're obviously, I'm sort of sitting here saying, yeah, it's over, I can't see anything good there. That's purely because the history suggests that's what's going to happen.
Yeah,
you know, City,
of course, yeah.
Done it for the last few years. Arsenal, you know, the last two seasons, they've thrown away, you know, something that they were looking to achieve from almost unfathomable positions. So history kind of tells you that, okay, are they going to, you know, do what they've done for the last couple of years? If you're one of those teams, if you're Liverpool or Arsenal, you've got to keep thinking, okay, we've still got to, you know, just win our games, and there's a chance that maybe they'll drop some points. If it was any other team, you know, I'd be saying, yeah, of course, it's still well on, but it's just... So Man City, they're just on a completely different level and have been for a while. I cannot see it.
Yeah, well, that is very difficult to see, isn't it? But like I say, you've got to...
You never know.
I mean, granted, I don't work for Sky or TNT. So I don't need to big this up, but whilst it's still possible. And there's only one swing, and it's like, you know, I mean, like, someone could snatch a draw against Man City. Arsenal, Liverpool win. Everyone's at 74 points. That'll be fun.
Yeah, like that should be the case. That everyone's thinking, it only takes one result.
Well, I thought,
how many times over the last few years you see City just win 12, 13, 14 in a row?
It was very noticeable at full time in both Arsenal and Liverpool games. The players looked like they just lost the World Cup final. Because I think my wife was saying, like, why are they so devastated? Like, there's only one result in it. I said, you don't chase Man City. Like, once they're ahead, they're ahead, and that's that.
But that, you know, I think one element of that, certainly with Arsenal, and I've always thought, you know, I've thought this for a while, I think, you know, they say, like, really, really good managers, their team is like a representation of them on the pitch. Arteta is so fucking ridiculous with his emotions.
Yeah,
that has to have an effect on the players. Like that, and you know, you think if that was Man City, say, who'd lost on this weekend to see themselves 2 points behind, you wouldn't see all their players, you know, sitting on the grass with their head in their hands or on their knees, looking like, you know, they've just seen a horrific car accidents or something from the look on the faces of the Arsenal players. You just wouldn't see that. They'd be like, okay, it's frustrating, but let's put it away. But it's almost like it's just a completely... I know it's a bad result. It's been a bad weekend. But you're right. It's, the look on their faces, it was like they just lost the World Cup final. Yeah.
Probably quite telling. And as you say, like, you know, Liverpool had a bad result in Europe in the week. If they go out of the Europa League on Thursday night coming, you just wonder, can they pick themselves off the canvas for that after, you know, after what's just gone on this weekend? Add that in the mix and it's like all of a sudden Klopp's leaving party becomes Klopp's, like, very sort of players are thinking, well, she's not going to be here next season. Am I going to be here next season? Do I want to be here? What's going on? Like, it all of a sudden changes the narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. But, which is, you know, we're all upset about, aren't we?
Oh, devastated. No, I mean, I honestly don't really care who wins the league. For me, I've always usually been a neutral in the title fight. Just want to see it be interesting. That's all I'm hoping for, but...
Yeah,
doesn't look like it's going to go that way. But well, you never know. Like I say, there's only one slip for Man City needed. Maybe Fulham will surprise them.
If there's any team left in their picture list,
it's Fulham. Fulham away on a lunch. It's a lunchtime kickoff as well. Ooh. Hey, don't you count your chickens just yet, Pep.
Yes, we shall see.
We shall. Right, that's. Concludes the round of this week. Tonight's game, I assume, will be covered by the boys and girls who come on for extra time. But spoiler, Chelsea beat Everton 6-0. Carl will be, well, it'd be many emotions, I imagine. He'll be tearing his pubes out at that one. not a good day for Everton. Cole Palmer, who goes from strength to strength to strength, scored 4, including having to fight 2 of his teammates for the right to take a penalty at 4-0. But
yeah,
whatever.
That was amusing.
It means the bottom three, which is the bottom, the sort of scrap end of the table, has gone very much under the radar because obviously Sky are too busy knocking themselves daft over the top end of the table. But Everton 27, Forest 26, Luton 25. Not an awful lot in it. But the problem is no one seems to be able to win down there.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be struggling to pick any of those three with any real degree of confidence to join Burnley and Sheffield United and going down. Like, it literally could be any of them. The Luton have got the most fight about them, but probably the least amount of quality. Everton, Forest. I mean, Everton, you just do not know where goals are coming from, and they had been defensively quite solid, so that tonight, I think, is going to a real kick in the knackers, isn't it?
They were dire tonight, and Branthwaite went off injured, and if that's enough to rule them out of any number of games, then it's Michael Keane time. So,
Well, Everton and Forest play each other on Sunday.
Oh.
I think that's the epitome of a six-pointer, isn't it?
That's two ball Ben fight over a comb, that. That's going to be that's going to be one for the ages.
For the neutral.
Well, we've got the truncated fixture list this weekend because the FA Cup semi-finals are on. So there's only 3 games on Saturday, including Wolves and Arsenal in a 7:30 kickoff, which is...
7:30?
I don't know why. So I'm guessing they didn't want to clash with one of the FA Cup games, so...
Oh, of course, yeah. It's Man City, Chelsea, 5:15.
Yeah, I was going to say, I bet as well that because Arsenal are in Europe on Wednesday night, they can't play 12:30 on Saturday. That's a rule now, so yeah, there they are. And then Sunday, we've got Everton Forest, as discussed. That's the TV lunchtime game. Villa Bournemouth, which is presumably, well, who knows? Bournemouth are insane. Anything could happen there. Palace West Ham, which, again, great. We didn't even talk about Palace, really. I mean, obviously, Glasner, who none of us know who he is, masterminded a win at Anfield. And then Fulham Liverpool, which Fulham can have a big say in this title race, apparently. But then when you get in the midweek, so we've got Arsenal Chelsea on Tuesday. There's 4 games on Wednesday, including Everton Liverpool. And then Thursday is Brighton Man City. So a lot will go on.
Yes, it's all heating up, isn't it? Business end of the season.
Yeah, well, I think what we'll probably do is next Monday we'll do our usual pod, obviously. But included in that, I'll send around one of those fixture predictors and we can see how it's all going to play out.
And, because we're always excellent with our predictions, aren't we?
So absolutely.
That'll be entertaining.
Yeah, well, it says here Fulham are going to finish 4th. Like, yeah, well, you better believe it.
Heard it here first, lads.
Right, let's wrap this baby up. Si, where can people find you on the internet?
So on Twitter, it's at Si O'Regan, and the Hulkcast podcast for any Villa fans who, or any other fan who's interested in hearing us be very giddy and wild of excitement at how the season's looks like it might be ending for us.
I'm sure a lot of rival clubs will tune into a Villa podcast to hear you be jubilant.
Oh, definitely.
If they didn't, they will now. You can find me on Twitter at CM9798. The website is CM9798.co.uk. We just started a new blog in Italy with Bologna. So keep an eye on that every Sunday morning. You can find the show on Twitter at Man on the Post, and we're also available in all your favourite podcast places, including Amazon Music. Just search Man on the Post. Simon, thank you very much, as ever.
Thank you, Dave. Always a pleasure.
Never a chore. And thank you all for listening, and always remember to keep your man on the post. Yours now, go out and take it all. You are the brightest star.